Look, I really wouldn't use the word debate. I think what we're having here tonight is very much a discussion. And in that spirit, I want to start by congratulating Ken for being the consistent voice of sanity in a very, sometimes a marginalised voice in terms of the media in this country. We've gone through a period now, stretching back a decade or more, in which the boosters and the boosters for the system have tried to convince us that everything is going upwards, that there is big money to be made, that we're all getting richer, that our houses are increasing in value, that somehow the people, the spivs and the profiteers who dabble in public-private partnerships, dabble in privatisation, who skim the money off the super schemes and run the finance advisory companies, that these are adding value to the world. And Ken has maintained a voice of sanity, saying that public-private partnerships are nothing more than an attempt to rip off for private benefit the public good and the public cost, that leveraged buyouts are an attempt to basically destroy companies from within at the expense of workers, and that, you know, the financial wheeling and dealing, which in very short order has led to hedge funds and derivatives and CDOs and all sorts of things which many of us are still only struggling to understand. Ken has spoken out and called it the hocus pocus that it is. And it's nice sometimes to be right, Ken, isn't it? It's nice to look at the apologists for the free market and see them in total disarray. Not so much the sort of the penny ante ones. You still populate too many of our lecture theatres and too many of the opinion pages in the newspapers. But the serious players in the system know that the game is up, know that capitalism is on the brink, if not going down the slope into the greatest crisis in our lifetimes, looking around the room, most of our lifetimes. A few people here may have been children in the 1930s, but for most of us, we are on the brink of the worst that is yet to come. And what that has done has begun, as Leon said in his introduction, has begun to open up a space for a discussion of alternatives, and a discussion which is very, very urgently needed, because if we sit and wait for capitalism to right itself, then there's a very real danger it will take us all down with it. Two dead white men, feature as alternatives in this debate. One is Karl Marx. Karl Marx was a revolutionary in deed as well as in word in the 19th century, a man who devoted his life to both understanding the capitalist system and fighting against it and organising workers' struggles. I'll come back to Marx's ideas. People, probably even people who don't think they agree with him, have heard of Karl Marx. The other player who has become much more central to intellectual and ideological discussion in recent times has been Keynes. Ironically, Keynes is, if you like, closer to the mainstream, but actually many people younger than me may not have heard of him. If you're my age or older, some of the Keynesian language was the language we grew up in. The idea that governments should pump prime and put money into public institutions and goods. That language has been wiped out for the most part in the last 30-odd years in particular. But Keynes was a very significant player in economic debate and discussion in the 20th century. A man who started off pretty much mainstream, pretty conservative, but who, under the impact of the Great Depression, which unfolded, broadly speaking, with the crash on Wall Street in 1929, and really went through the 1930s, a period of enormous privation, where a quarter or a third of the population were unemployed in advanced countries like the US and Australia. Keynes stood against the stream and was both was critical of some of the central, what we would now call free market ideas that dominated ideological debate, and could be quite a trenchant and sometimes radical sounding critic of the system. He said in Dublin in 1933, "With what we have spent on the dole in England since the war," meaning the First World War, "we could have made our cities the greatest works of man in the world." So he understood the waste of the system. And he carved out a particular space by disagreeing with two central ideas being pushed by the free marketeers of the day. The first idea, a little sort of technical, was the idea that everything that was produced would somehow be sold. It was a thing called Say's Law, the idea that essentially the economy was self-balancing. If it was made, if it was produced, if it was sold, then the economy would balance out at the other end. And Keynes pointed out what was rapidly becoming the bleeding obvious, but he pointed out that that wasn't necessarily the case, that the rich were quite capable of taking their profits and then sitting on them and not reinvesting them. And as a result, the system could then go into crisis. The other thing that Keynes argued against was the idea, and he published a book in 1936, his general theory, which summed up these ideas. He argued against the ideas of wage cutting. The immediate response to the Great Depression in bourgeois economics was to cut wages, which not only led to enormous privation for the workers whose wages were being cut, and incidentally the dole was also cut as a consequence, but also led, if you think about it quite logically, to a reduction in demand, which then led to a downward spiral in the economy, which led to further job losses, further misery, further privation, and the rest of it. So Keynes carved out a position as the person who said, firstly, that government should intervene, should borrow, should spend money in order to boost the economy and to begin to turn that downward spiral into an upward spiral. And secondly, and this obviously made him very popular in many quarters, argued that workers should not have their wages cut. Now, those arguments, if you look at the world today, the idea that governments should intervene, and if you look at, you know, Kevin Rudd's $900 and tax cuts and the like, the idea that actually workers' disposable income should, if anything, be increased rather than decreased, would seem to indicate that Keynes has already won the argument, or the Keynesians have already won the argument in 2008 and 2009. The level of state intervention, government intervention, has been absolutely unprecedented in recent times. But I think we have to be very cautious, and I think it's no coincidence that Keynes is still on the margins in terms of the debate even in The Age, let alone in other parts of society, in declaring that neoliberalism, the idea of letting the free market rip, that those ideas are dead, and that the Keynesian ideas of government intervention and spending have won. I think you look at, for instance, the essay by Kevin Rudd in the Monthly magazine, which some people may have read and many people may have heard of, a few months ago, where he ripped into neoliberalism and said what a rotten system it was. When you read the article very closely, he's talking about one thing and one aspect of the system only, and that is the deregulation of the finance markets. Actually, you will find no disagreement from Kevin Rudd with privatisation or with restrictions on workers' rights to strike, or with shifting money into the pockets of the wealthy. In other words, those neoliberal ideas that the state should intervene not to boost the economy, but actually to hold down workers' ability to fight, workers' ability to raise their living standards, to hold down the social wage, to shift resources from the public to the private sector, those ideas are not dead. They are not dead, and therefore this debate continues to be of fundamental importance. There were two problems from a Marxist point of view, and I'm arguing from the Marxist point of view, with what Keynes had to argue. The first is that Keynes was actually very, very cautious. He was, after all, an establishment figure in terms of being an economist and a contributor to public debate. And he was acutely aware of what he called the animal spirits of the capitalists, the sense that psychology came into play in the decisions about whether to invest or not to invest. And that led to him being quite cautious about doing anything that would actually make the employers nervous. And in fact, he went further. He actually argued that if our central controls succeed in establishing full employment, and he's talking about state intervention, the classical theory, meaning the free market theory, comes into its own again. Then there is no objection against the classical analysis of the manner in which private interest will determine what in particular is produced, in what proportions, etc., etc. In other words, Keynes consciously saw himself as intervening, not to bring capitalism down as a rotten system that plunges us into unemployment, poverty, war, and increasingly in the modern era into climate destruction. He actually saw intervention by governments, guided by people like themselves, as about saving capitalism from itself and ultimately stabilising it, but still stabilising it with a very rich minority at the top and the bulk of workers and the poor. And because he was scared of upsetting that capitalist status quo, although he has a reputation for arguing for substantial state intervention, actually his measures were quite cautious. It's estimated that the public works program, which he supported, would have perhaps knocked 11% off the unemployment figures, sounds good, at a time when between 1930 and 1933, unemployment doubled, went up by 100%. So he argued for public works, but at a level which could not deal with the rising level of unemployment. Another estimate calculates that to provide the 3 million jobs needed in Britain at the time to get rid of unemployment would have needed an increase in government spending of 56%. That's not somewhere where Keynes was prepared to go. If you put that into today's context, one estimate of the bubble in the assets and financial market at the moment is that it's reached $290 trillion, give or take, you know, here or there. That is five times the level of world gross domestic product. Everything that is produced worldwide times five. When you have that level of bubble, that level of economic crisis, then surely we can't afford to tinker at the edges. There is an idea around that Keynes's measures actually led to the end of the Great Depression. In reality, I would argue that's actually not the case. The high point of US government spending in the 1930s was 9% of GDP. Today, the US government spends over 20% of GDP. In other words, the level of government intervention in the 30s was not that substantial. What turned it around was World War II, where the US government and other governments did what Keynes never dared to suggest, and that was effectively take overall control of the economy. By 1943, 90% of all investment in the United States was decided by the government. And I know it's a big room and you can't see it from here, but here's a little graph, unfortunately, which indicates the level of federal spending in the US over time. That's the 1930s, when supposedly the extra spending was dealing with unemployment. That's the Second World War, and then back again. The level of spending today is much higher than it was in the 30s. It is the massive shift in government spending and government direction of the economy in the Second World War period that ended the Depression. And it ended the Depression at the loss of 50 million cities, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, Dresden, Coventry, Darwin, and the rest. So I want to ask the question, moving on to sort of posing, the Marxist alternative to this. What did Keynes miss? Because he was right that there was a problem that the employers would not invest. And he was right that the government had a duty and had a responsibility to invest in their place. There's really no argument about that. We can argue about the scale, we can argue about the effectiveness, but we don't need to argue about that central idea. But really the question we have to ask is, why were the bosses holding back? Why weren't they investing? And that's where Marx, I think, has something really very useful to say, not just in terms of historical debate, but in terms of how we understand the world today and how we should proceed. Marx started with a simple proposition that the source of value in society came from human labour, mixed with the natural products of the world, but human labour. We are the producers. We are the people who create the roads, the factories, the hospitals, the schools, who provide the services, who do everything. That is the essential source of value. In that, by the way, Adam Smith, who is the founding father of capitalist economics, tended to agree, but that idea was very, very radical, very revolutionary, got brushed under the carpet well before Marx came along. So workers produce surplus. The bosses want to take that surplus from us, and that's in order to reinvest and in order to create their profits. They do so in a situation where they're in competition with each other, and therefore each is looking for an advantage over the other. And to get to gain that advantage, they will look to actually invest in the newest technology, the newest machinery, infrastructure and the like. The problem is, the more that the bosses invest into equipment as opposed into human labour, the lower the level of profit that comes back, because they're reducing the level of living labour, the proportion of living labour inside the system, which is the source of value. So paradoxically, the economy can boom, the paper profits, the headline profits, can be enormous, and bosses can actually be enormously depressed because the level, the rate of profit they're getting is declining and declining and declining. This isn't absolute. I'm painting a very broad picture, but it's a tendency that exists within within capitalism. If this is the case, it leads to an outcome. They attempt to screw more out of us. Neoliberalism is just the latest way in which the bosses try and shift the balance in order to extract more surplus from us, the workers. It could be directly in the workplace through longer hours, lower wages, getting us to, making people redundant and getting the rest to pick up their work. It could be indirectly to us by cutting back on the social wage, by making us feel that we've got to take out private health insurance and essentially shifting the cost of healthcare away from the public expenditure, which comes from tax, and onto us as private individuals. So they can try and screw us down. They can increase that level of exploitation. That incidentally leads to struggle. That's why workers fight back. Not because socialists have told them to, but because they resent bosses trying to screw more out of them when they already feel that they've given enough. And the bosses, if they do not achieve the kind of rate of profit that makes it worthwhile to reinvest their surplus into new production and expand the system, then look for somewhere for that surplus to go. And what we've seen in the post-war period is a significant reduction in the rate of profit within capitalism. We saw it in the run-up to the Great Depression. Between the 1880s and the 1920s in the United States, what's called the organic composition of capital, the proportion of machinery to human beings went up by 20% in the US, and the rate of profit came down by 40%. That really is the explanation for the Wall Street crash and the depression that goes on. What we've seen in the post-war period, and I'll just take a for instance, but it's a significant for instance, and this is US manufacturing. In 1950 in the US, it was about 24%. It went up, peaked in the early 1950s at almost 30% profit. For every $100 a capitalist invested, they got $30 back in surplus. That's not bad. You try going down to the local savings bank and getting 30% on your meagre savings, you're not going to get it. 30% is very good. It goes up, it goes down, but it goes down. By the mid-1980s, it's down to about 5%. Now, at 5%, you seriously begin to think, should I bother to build that new factory, or should I put the money in a deposit account at a bank? Reagan comes in. He starts to screw down on workers' living standards. He smashes the unions. He drives American workers' living standards down, and the rate of profit begins to increase again, but significantly increases to probably only about half of what it was in the 1950s. So bosses are still making profits, but many of them are not confident enough that if they invest them, they are going to get a substantial enough return to justify their investment, so they speculate. The money then goes off into the financial market, which dwarfs the real world, the trillions of dollars in speculation. It starts with currency swaps and currency exchanges, speculation on the price of pork bellies and bags of corn. And then increasingly, clever clogs with MBAs come out and essentially invent devices to increase the level of gambling in the casino of world capitalism and take it to even greater levels of sophistication. And so they begin to get into derivatives and hedge funds to the point where when the system goes bang, as it did do in about September, October last year with the collapse of Lehman Brothers in the United States, credit freezes up because nobody knows who's bust. Nobody knows who's got money. The banks sit tight, scared to lend. Bosses who are relying on credit to keep their businesses going begin to go bust. We've seen, 5 million workers lose their jobs in the US already. The bubble is burst, and they're desperately scrambling to throw our money into the banks in order to head off this catastrophe. I'm going to move to sum up because there are lots of gaps I'm leaving in this, but I hope in the discussion we can begin to flesh some of it out.
I'll sum up in five minutes.
What I outlined has a number of implications. If Marx was generally right, and if Marxists today are broadly right in terms of our analysis of the system and our critique of the system. The first is, what we're dealing with is a systemic problem. Literally, it's a problem of the system. The capitalism is not something that's been hijacked by some greedy financiers, or a bit of deregulation has had what is essentially a good system kiltering out of control. At the heart of capitalism is the employers essentially grinding the surplus out of the workers and the peasants, but primarily the workers who create the wealth in our society. And I'm assuming there aren't many capitalists in this room, there's a lot of workers, so I'm talking about us and many others like us. So if that is at the heart of the system, and if the competition between bosses leads to greater investment, which ironically actually undercuts the bosses' own source of profits, then this isn't something that can be tinkered with through deregulation. The system is fundamentally flawed, and the system has to be overthrown. And while we sympathise and agree with many of the stimulus elements of the stimulus package which are around, the conclusion from what we're saying isn't take your $900, Kevin Rudd, and, you know, and give it to somebody else. Yes, thank you very much. You know, we'll take that and give some of it to the revolutionary cause. Our conclusion is not to reject stimulus packages. It's to do two things. Firstly, it's to be very critical of elements of it, which are clearly just pouring good money after bad into the pockets of banks and other institutions, which have basically squandered our funds. We're in favour of insulating people's homes. We're in favour of maternity leave. We're in favour of increasing the age pension. We're in favour of giving workers, especially low-paid workers, $900. It makes a lot of difference in a lot of, you know, family homes around the place, that money. But at the same time, we challenge the idea that stimulus is about saving the capitalists. If the government is going to spend money, it should be on things which benefit us as a society. So I echo, in a sense, the theme of the Green New Deal that many people have raised, that now is the perfect time to actually be shifting huge resources in our society into, for instance, renewable energy. If we're going to put money into the economy, let's do it in a way that's going to be an achievement for the generations to come. A stimulus package element that consists of putting a better road or a better railway from a coal mine to a port is actually not a good investment for the future. It's not an investment in the future of the planet and human beings. So we're for stimulus packages, but we're for stimulus packages that benefit workers, that benefit the environment. But at the same time, we do not think that stimulus packages are going to save capitalism from itself. So we are we're friendly critics of the idea of stimulus packages. The flip side of that argument is that one of the key tasks of Marxists today is actually to argue with our workmates and argue as far as possibly through broad society that we're not responsible, let's say we, the working class, the poor, the direct producers, the peasants in the third world, the workers everywhere. We are not responsible for this system. We weren't running the system. We weren't by and large benefiting from the system, and we shouldn't be paying the price for the system. You take that sort of jargon and break it down into small chips, what it means is we fight job losses. We don't mourn them. We welcome and urge workers to copy the workers in Ireland and the workers in Britain and the workers in America who have occupied their factories in order to fight for jobs. We reject the idea that shorter working week and a cut in the wage is going to save us. Actually, what it'll do is depress us, demoralise us, weaken us, and make us easier to be sacked when the boss comes along 3 months later and says, well, that wasn't enough, we're getting rid of jobs anyway. We reject the idea that now is the time to put money into insolvent banks rather than into renewable energy. We reject the idea that workers should have to pay. Actually, we turn it around and say, Kevin Rudd, if you think we need a stimulus package, come down to our picket line at the National Tertiary Education Union, at RMIT, at Melbourne Uni, at La Trobe Uni. We're going to be on strike in the university. I'm a university worker. We're going to be on strike right across the university system in Melbourne on Thursday, because we haven't had a pay offer in a year of negotiation from management. Kevin Rudd, if you believe in stimulus packages, come and stand on our picket line and help us win one. And that's what we want to turn around. Because in the process of standing against the call for austerity, in the process of fighting against job cuts, in the process of rejecting responsibility for the crisis, then working class people can begin to get some sense of their own importance, their own worth, or their own power within this society. We should not be, we must not be, pawns of a system that is wrecking our lives and wrecking our planet. And that's the central answer from Marx.
Thank you, David. Now, Kenneth has 20 minutes, and whilst just sitting there, think about questions.
Well, thank you. You probably didn't see the magazine that was flashed there. This is a Dissent magazine, which we, my partner and I, Leslie, produce in our spare time. I have to say that it's probably Keynesian in flavour. But I want to try and reconcile some of the ideas, the contending views of how the economy worked tonight. First of all, economic theory is essentially a rationalisation of particular historical experiences. The core proposition of each economic theory is that they're not amenable to empirical investigation, and so observation is unable to separate the different theories. So you really can't prove that Marx is right, Keynes is right or wrong, or even, as I'll say earlier, that there are some aspects of classical economics which are perfectly respectable and can be applied with profit to some of the issues we see today. The other point is, the more the economic issue that's being discussed is, the more that economic issue and the techniques of dealing with it look like history. Issues have to be analysed through time, and if you're looking at issues through time, there isn't experiments there which can be repeated. Every part of time is unique. The most economists have a fairly, whatever they may say, have a fairly simple model of how the economy works rattling around in their heads. The classical economists, the main proposition, I would say, of classical economics is one called, which economists called opportunity cost. And all that means is that if you spend a quid one way, it's a quid that can't be spent another way. In terms of Marxist economics, I think it's important. It provides a theory of class relations and, for me, a conclusion. If the policy doesn't satisfy the dominant class interest, then it's unlikely that the policy is likely to get up, and if you disagree with that very depressing conclusion, I think you should look at the behaviour of all the major sides of politics in Australia today, and you could probably do the same exercise in other countries. Keynes, of course, as we all know, wrote the general, what's called the general theory of employment, interest and money. Money, he saw that as quite crucial to the system, and money, unlike Marx and also the classical economists, I think it's fair to say they tend to see money as a veil through which you try and peer to get at the reality of economic events. Well, Keynes was one of the first people to say, no, that's not right. Money has a role in this whole thing, and if you attempt to ignore that, to peer through it, then you are not seeing how the economy is working. In terms of the Keynesian ideas, the way I like to express his truths are, first of all, it's not the task of economics in terms of budgetary policy is to balance the economy, not the budget. If you think about a sailing boat sailing on the ocean, the direction where the boat should actually be pointed at any time depends on not where you're going necessarily, but how the boat relates to the wind and the various climatic conditions. You have to take that into account in order to get where you want to go. We want to balance the economy. It doesn't particularly matter, per se, whether the budget is balanced, or, for that matter, how big the deficit should be. It depends on what is happening in the rest of the economy that matters. The second proposition is that equilibrium exists, but it can exist well below full employment, and we've seen that from history, and we're seeing that now. Most people now accept, because their lives, in a sense, depend on it, including the rich, going back to my Marxist point, that if it serves the dominant class interest, you'll find it'll get up pretty quickly. Most people realise that in order to survive, there will need to be a lot of pump priming in the economy. At the same time, they want to feel moralistic about this and so on too, so they talk about debt and how this is imposing this terrible burden of debt in the future. We must get the debt down as quickly as possible because we'll be leaving some horrible mess for our children. That again is not necessarily right, it could be right, but providing the investments that are undertaken to, in the current situation, to offset the recession, will give a yield of better than the long-term bond rate, then the country will be better off as a result of taking on that debt. Another point, which is perhaps more exotic, esoteric, but it is very important nevertheless. Marx also saw that savings are a function of investment. It's possible for the individual to save money and put it in the bank or stuff it under the mattress. But for an economy as a whole, for a country as a whole, to attempt to save money first and then invest it somewhere down the track, you are in fact really heading for recession. After all, savings is a function of income, that it's by generating income that you generate savings. I would say that if you are dealing with issues such as the environment, then classical economics are a fairly good guide. If you are looking at the way the world operates and economics is a sort of a moral science, then Marx has a lot of insights for for all of us. Marx, I would say, together with Malthus, which I expect most people would I've heard of here, who is warned about exponential population growth. His predictions are now coming true. Both those important thinkers, to my mind, they're important because they saw the dynamic nature of society and economy and attempted to develop a theory to explain that dynamic nature. And they've succeeded with a reasonable degree of success. Now, getting to the recession, how long have I got, by the way? 10 minutes. Right, right. The immediate cause of the global financial crisis was the extension of financial leverage, financial institutions lending more and more on a smaller and smaller equity base. And the lending, what is called, not simply by Marxists, but by other people, predatory lending, which is lending money to people to whom it's obvious that they will never be able to pay the interest on the loan, let alone the principal. Millions of low-income Americans, mainly Afro-American and Hispanic, had no access to affordable housing as government cut public housing programs. This created, apparently, a commercial opportunity. US banks offered mortgages to low-income people at initially low rates, but hid the fine print that there would be a shift to high interest rates down the track. The lenders knew this. They were quite cold-blooded about it. They knew this, but they gambled that rising house prices would cover the cost of defaults, and in any case, they would be able to bundle the loans into securities which were promoted and sold as investments with high but acceptable risks with high interest returns. The banks paid rating agencies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's to give these new financial products high credit ratings, which were then sold on to other banks, local governments, semi-government authorities, and superannuation funds all over the world. This created contaminated time bombs in the global financial system. Banking business in the US had been transferred from originate loans and hold, that is, you're responsible for the loans you issue to your customers, that's classical banking, so you're careful who you lend the money to. But banking was changed into a system of originate and distribute it. In other words, you sold somebody this loan and then you got rid of it as quickly as possible. You bundled it up and passed it on to somebody else in the manner of a card game where the loser is the player left holding the joker or the old mate at the end of the game or the parcel in Pass the Parcel when the music stops. So the music stopped in 2007, 2008, and now even banks are reluctant to lend to each other as well as their customers, despite the cuts in official interest rates and cash injections into banks to free up lending. So we have a crisis of confidence. Now the world is caught in what Keynes called a liquidity, and what he would call if he was around now, a liquidity trap. There is a limit to how far down interest rates can be pushed to reflate the economy. Deflation rather than inflation is the big risk at present. Even with zero interest rates, if prices are contracting, real interest rates are rising. Modern inflation provides an incentive to bring expenditure forward. Deflationary expectations are an incentive to hoard cash and postpone investment and discretionary expenditure to get the benefit of lower prices in the future. We are caught in what Keynes called the paradox of thrift. For the nation, it is rational for individual consumers and investors to spend to promote employment and output. For the nation, it's rational for the for individual consumers and investors to spend. It's rational for them to do it. But for the individual who holds fear for his job or is uncertain about whether there'll be additional demand necessary to justify new investment, expanding spending, particularly if it involves going to debt, is highly irrational. So in other words, you've got these two conflicting pressures. One which says if we were concerned about the whole system, we would go out and spend all our money and go into debt. But we're told to go out and spend more money, but we all know that's crazy because you could lose your job any moment. In a situation of great uncertainty about the future, policies to loosen monetary policy or to cut taxes to boost private spending can be likened to pushing on a string. That's another old Keynesian idea. Either the policy is likely to be ineffectual until confidence picks up when the direction of policy should be to dampen demand. In other words, these policies of saying, you know, leave it up to the market, we can give a stimulus in terms of we can cut interest rates, we can even give you negative interest rates if we have to, or we'll give you a tax cut, that's not going to work. So how much fiscal stimulus is necessary to minimise the rise in unemployment, and how much is prudent? The threat of deflation is the number one priority after the threat of unemployment. And if a society goes into a deflationary spiral, you're in far, far bigger trouble than what we are now. The main problem is the size of the budgetary stimulus the government is, will be prepared to undertake. We're all Keynesian now, but only up to the point based on an imperfect understanding of Keynesian ideas. So, here we are. I've skated across a fair amount of this stuff, but I'm happy, and I'm sure all of you, or some of you, will want to ask questions. So,
you've got 5 minutes left.
Oh no, I'll leave it there, and that's more time for this excellent audience to ask questions.
Take one more question, and then 5 minutes from the speaker. So, or well, two more. Okay.
I don't think the question before that was asked about Keynes' approach to the declining rate of profit actually got answered. I'm sure if Keynes could probably maybe answer that.
Well,
about, yeah, what Keynes actually said
about rate of profit. Well, I suppose he did say something about rate of profit, but I can't remember it now. I mean, what he was concerned about writing about the Great Depression was how you get the economy restarted, and the key to that, as far as he was concerned, was stimulating demand, which had to be done by government because of the question of the paradox of thrift. I agree with the general point that ultimately economic questions are political questions, and economists, the way I look at it is, in an age of religion, priests and cardinals and so on were very influential, because what they did was to explain to the local monarch that he had a divine right to kick the bejesus out of the peasants in the next area. And economists, in a sense, really do, in normal times, provide the same sort of role now. They explain to people who are bastards, who are greedy, that their greed isn't antisocial, but in fact, this is the thing that drives progress. And one of the reasons for studying economics is to, so that you can at least see through some of the bullshit and don't be conned by it. At least that's what I try and do, and illuminate a few simple propositions. So I can see a few people smiling now, so I think it's probably a good idea for me to sit down and chat.
David, 5 minutes or?
No, we finished here. Look, I won't take 5 minutes, but I do want to say this. I think the stakes are quite high. What we're looking at, if we sort of take, you know, float out of this building, you know, have an out-of-body experience, rather than being in this little room at the bottom of Trades Hall, sort of go up and have a Google Earth view of the world. Actually, we're facing some really serious shit. We're facing the possibility, I'll come back to that in a moment, the possibility of lurching into effectively a depression. And the last depression led to the Second World War, as surely as one thing follows the other. We certainly face a catastrophe, a potential catastrophe in terms of climate change. And we all, I think, are very much aware by now that the clock is ticking on action. And we have a ruling class that is more interested in propping up bankrupt banks than it is in actually doing something about climate change. And we have the possibility of human misery on a scale we haven't seen for many, many years, or many, many decades, and perhaps on a greater scale than in modern times. If you take the combination of an economic catastrophe and a climate catastrophe, we are talking about the impoverishment and possibly the deaths of hundreds of millions of people. Not the end of the world, but massive, massive misery. It may not be what I'm painting. I'm not saying that that's a done deal. It may be that somehow the trillions that are being thrown in by Obama and, you know, the smaller figures around the world just stay things off. It may be that cheap credit and stimulus packages, just for the moment, begin to get the motor ticking over again, and that the recession doesn't turn into a fully fledged depression, and we only have a year or a year and a half of economic misery. That may happen, but if it happens, the one thing I am prepared to say for what it's worth, with some degree of certainty, is it will only buy us some time. Because the underlying problems of the profitability of capitalism can only be eradicated by a massive assault on working class living standards, the kind that cannot be carried through politely in normal times. They have to be carried through in circumstances of dictatorship or war or some form of national emergency. And that ain't happening at the moment. And therefore, even if the system staggers on and briefly revives, the underlying problems of profitability, the underlying problems of bad debt will continue. And what will happen is, rather than the dot-com bubble that we had in the 1990s being replaced by the housing bubble of the 2000s, then something else will happen. There will be a bubble of some other sort. That the money will not go into regenerating the economy, far less going into a 100% renewables by 2020. It will go into some other form of speculation, and the whole rotten process will start off over again. And then we will be back in that same situation some years down the track. So I'm not saying that we are moving into a depression, but what I'm saying is that the system has some fundamental flaws which indicate that either we put it out of its misery or it will put us out of our misery, and that we face a choice. Now, if I'm even remotely right, that has consequences. Firstly, it means we all need to understand the system more in order to fight it, and that means we all have to become more familiar with some of these ideas we've begun to discuss tonight. I don't think any of us can say we know enough, and we need to read, and as Marxists we have resources, many more resources even than are here. So we need to organise around ideas of an alternative based on human need, not on the demands of the profit system, and we need to act on it. Ideas alone do not change the world. Ideas fused with the determination and the courage and the commitment of individuals and masses of individuals is what changes the world. So I urge you to do three things. Firstly, read. We all need to read and debate and understand. Secondly, if you're in the city or you're close to any of the university campuses, come and support the picket line on Thursday morning. I'm not saying it's the most important strike, it just happens to be the one I'm involved in personally, but it happens to be a strike that's very public and it's taking place in a lot of places around Melbourne, and it's one that would be very easy to walk up to and show your support on the picket line. And thirdly, if you agree with the kind of arguments we're putting forward, even if you're not sure about every detail, but if you agree with that fundamental direction in which I'm arguing, the direction of Marx, which I believe is the direction of humanity, then join us, join solidarity. Because we need organisation in order for both the ideas and the actions to be as effective and widespread and deep and thorough as possible. Thank you.